to bring my mother to her apartment for a day or two to acclimatise, but we hadn't time to waste in Shenyang. I had thought carefully about the next section of the journey. A flight to Kunming would have been fastest, taking just 6 hours, but it was out of the question. The airport authorities would certainly scrutinise our IDs. The train would take 2 full days, but ID checks on trains were even more worrying because they would be face to face. The least perilous option was going by road. It would be grueling. With all the transfers and waiting times, I figured the journey would take a week. And although there would be more police checks, the driver usually handed all the IDs to the policeman who'd check each with a handheld machine, but wouldn't match them against the owners. We braced ourselves again. We were going to cross 8 vast provinces of China by coach. If we encountered any more problems like the one on leaving Changbai, we would pretend that my mother and Mino were deaf mutes and that I was their guide. It was a desperate, crazy, ridiculous idea, but it was the only one I had. The next leg of the journey was to Zhengzhou, the capital of Henan province, on the Yellow River, almost 900 miles southwest of Shenyang. It would be an 18-hour ride. We reached the first police checkpoint 1 hour into the journey. As I had hoped, the conductor collected all IDs and handed them to the policeman, who took them away for inspection. In our ordeal on the coach at Changbai, I thought I'd seen the soldier glance down to the back as he'd entered. He had probably spotted Mino straight away. This time, I had opted to sit up front in the most conspicuous place. We'd look as if we had nothing to hide. Again, we took seats on the second level, with Mino at a window, me in the middle, and as the seat beside me was taken, my mother behind me, also in the middle section. 10 minutes later, the policeman returned and handed the cards back to the driver. The moment the automatic door closed, we breathed again. We were in the clear. The three of us began talking freely. We felt rested. We'd had a good night's sleep at a hotel in Shenyang. So we chatted and ate snacks. The coach was full. By this time, if they didn't think we were Korean Chinese, every passenger would have guessed we either came from a minority ethnic group or we were foreigners. The coach stopped twice at restaurants on the expressway, and the passengers filed off to stretch their legs, use the washrooms and eat. 7 or 8 hours later, the coach stopped again. It was in the early hours of the morning, and we were somewhere near Beijing. Up ahead, blue lights revolved and flashed on top of a police jeep. Again, the conductor collected our passes, handed them to a policeman. 10 minutes later, the policeman climbed in. He had the IDs in his hand. He told the driver to pull off the road and turn the interior lights on. I caught a draft from the aircon overhead and felt beads of cold sweat on my brow. The policeman looked at the top card, called out a name, and a passenger lumbered down the aisle to claim it. "Name," he said. "Your residence? Where are you going? What's the purpose of your visit?" After the passenger had answered the last question, the policeman handed over the ID. The full horror of what was happening sank in. He's looking for illegals who can't speak Mandarin. I felt exposed and helpless. Our high-spirited conversations in Korean had given us away. A muscle began to spasm just beneath my eye. I had to grimace to make it stop. "This is it. We're finished." I looked over to see if my mother and Mino had caught what was happening. Mino was surreptitiously sipping from a cheap bottle of Maotai, the Chinese liquor. The rank, sickly smell of it had already reached my bunk. He said his strategy, if questioned, was to be drunk. He quietly screwed the cap back on and closed his eyes. His lips were pressed tightly together. I felt immensely sorry for him, and for my mother. This was all my doing. They could be safe at home now. They will pay the price for my selfishness. Mino's distraction strategy was not going to work. "Changsu!" The policeman was calling the name on Mino's ID. The name was Korean, but he was pronouncing it in Mandarin. Mino's eyes were still shut. There was nothing I could do. He called the name out again. No response. Then he called it a third time, irritated now. I pushed Mino, pretending to wake him. The other passengers watched as he climbed down from the bunk. I could see his legs wobbling. He was moving slowly, as if stepping forward to be shot. My heart was bleeding for him. But I could not do as a broker would have done, shrink back into my bunk, look out of the window, and abandon him to his fate. I'll take the bullet for him. What is your name? The policeman asked in Mandarin. Mino stood helplessly in front of him with his head lowered. He said nothing. The policeman looked at the card and looked up at him. He's deaf and dumb, I said in Mandarin, climbing down from my bunk. Who are you? We're together, I said. He found my card. Really? He's deaf and dumb? The policeman was holding my ID and Mino's out in front of him. Yours is in Chinese, but his is foreign. That's Korean script, I said. For Korean Chinese from the Northeast, the ID is in both languages. Never seen that before. She's right, the conductor chipped in. I turned my head and saw the driver tap the watch on his wrist in a show of irritation. The cards are all like that in the Korean autonomous provinces. The novelty of the Korean script had distracted the policeman from the ID's photo and date of birth. He still looked suspiciously at Mino. Then he handed back the card. Suddenly, a loud ape-like grunting noise behind me distracted everyone. My mother had clambered down from her berth. She was gibbering as if unaware she was making any sounds, and waving her arms about in a show of extreme annoyance, or as if she skipped her medication. The performance was so startling the policeman took a step backward. He swore. Another one? She's with me too, I said, sounding apologetic. I am guiding them both. Reluctantly, the policeman gave back our cards without further questions. The entire coach was watching this bizarre piece of theatre. They'd heard us chatting for hours. They might have been too surprised to speak, but not one of them gave us away. I had 52 accomplices to a crime, and they were all total strangers. A minute later, the coach was back on the expressway. Mino and my mother looked like people just spared the firing squad. Behind me, I could feel the heat of the other passengers' stares. I wanted to turn and say something by way of an excuse, or to thank them, but I was too embarrassed and scared. The rest of the journey lasted 8 hours. My mother and Mino did not utter another word. We arrived in Zhengzhou in the late afternoon, and from there travelled to Guilin, the capital of Guangxi province, unnoticed among a group of tourists on their way to see the famous Cast Hills along the Li River. We dozed for much of the 24-hour journey. Occasionally I'd pull back the curtain and see a vast Asian sky over endless low hills. The chill northeast was far behind us. We emerged in subtropical China. Another overnight ride westward, and on the morning of the seventh day, we reached Kunming, in Yunnan province. I was feeling a mounting sense of purpose and excitement. We were so close to the edge of China, the border to freedom. We were going to make it. We were going to pull this off. Reverend Kim's broker was waiting for us in the ticket hall of Kunming coach station. He was a tanned, middle-aged Chinese man dressed in black jeans, a cheap leather jacket and tinted glasses. He introduced himself as Mr. Fang. I had an instant bad feeling about him. I was his client and was paying for his services. But from the moment he greeted us, he behaved as if we'd been sent to irritate him, and he was doing us a favour. I watched him glance at my mother and shake his head. She had once ranked highly in her society and was the wife of a senior military officer. But in this fellow's eyes, she was an empty-handed old woman on the run. His body language showed contempt, his manner of speaking even more so. I'll admit that, as a Korean, I'm sensitive to how I'm treated. In our hierarchical culture, everyone is either above or below you. Honorific language is used with anyone further up the hierarchy. The safe bet when meeting strangers is to use polite forms until you can place their age or status. But this man began speaking to us in a language reserved for kids. He was especially dismissive of Mino. That fool's taking his time, he said when Mino was in the station bathroom. If we'd been in Seoul, I'd have told him plainly to his face to watch his manners, but I kept my anger banked down. I could not allow my feelings to interfere with our goal. I forced myself to treat the situation as another type of checkpoint, to be passed with calm nerves and composure. My family's safety came first. Mr. Fang's Korean was so thickly clouded with Mandarin that I had to keep asking him to repeat himself. I'd never heard Korean so mangled. In the end, I had to ask him to speak in Mandarin, which further annoyed him. My mother and Mino, meanwhile, were not reacting well to the fog of humidity we'd stepped into off the coach, or the pervasive reek of gasoline fumes. To make matters worse, the oily fried food we'd been eating at expressway restaurants all the way from Shenyang was taking its toll. Their bodies weren't used to it. They now had stomach cramps. Mino, who possessed such sinewy strength, had become listless and wan at the very stage of the journey he needed to be taut and alert. Mr. Fang led us to a guest house for the night. It was the cheapest kind of lodging, in a rough neighbourhood of old single-storey houses separated by narrow litter-strewn dirt alleyways. When I turned on the bathroom light, tiny lizards darted across the walls. The shower head was a spigot with a sock tied over it. Mr. Fang sat down on a bed. Payment was the first thing he mentioned. Without asking if we minded whether he smoked in our room, he lit a cigarette. I took out my cash. From my experience of gangs and brokers, I knew that the worst thing I could do was betray any sign of desperation or appeal to his pity. I spoke as if this was a controlled, manageable situation. When I arranged this with Reverend Kim, we only planned for my mother, but there was a problem and my brother had to come with us. Right now, I only have the money for one person. We had an agreement. We still do, I said. As soon as I return to Seoul, I'll pay the extra to Reverend Kim. He can transfer it to you. The man swore under his breath. That's not going to work, little miss. It will, because I'm giving you my South Korean ID card. I took it from my wallet and handed it to him. You keep it. You and Reverend Kim now know exactly who I am and where I live and can come after me if I don't pay. And I will pay. The ID was the only thing I had that might persuade him to trust me. He seemed to weigh the card in his hand for a moment, gauging its value, then slipped it into his jacket pocket.
They leave tomorrow, he said, nodding to my mother and Mino. They will be guided early in the morning over the border. Into Laos.
Where? No, we're going to Vietnam.
That was the plan, but 2 days ago a group of North Koreans was caught in Vietnam and sent back to China.
I glanced at my mother. She wasn't following the Mandarin, but she could see the alarm in my eyes.
The Vietnamese used to allow you people to go to South Korea, he said. We don't know why this has changed, but it means that route is not safe now. We can't risk it. We're switching to Laos.
My head was spinning. Where's Laos?
Next to Vietnam. Same distance from here. 7 hours away.
Is it safe?
Safe? He gave a snort. Nothing is guaranteed. But we've been doing this a long time. We can get you across the border into the South Korean embassy in Vientiane.
He saw another blank look on my face.
That's the capital. I'll get your mother and brother there.
He took a final drag on his cigarette and flicked it through the open window, trailing orange sparks.
Well, I'm going too, I said. No, you're not.
He shot me a look of glinting suspicion, as if I were trying to steal his trade secrets.
You're going back to Seoul.
I'm not leaving them. They need me.
They'll be in safe hands.
They don't speak Mandarin, and they don't know about anything outside of North Korea. I'm staying with them.
Too dangerous. You'll be a liability, little miss.
My fists clenched. If he calls me that one more time...
Everything we're doing is illegal, he said. With a South Korean passport, you can enter Laos for 15 days without a visa.
They don't even have passports. He gestured casually at my mother and Mino.
If you're caught with them, you'll be arrested for helping illegals. They'll think you're a broker and put you in jail. You'll be no help to anyone there. They need you to arrange things for them in South Korea. I could travel on my Chinese ID, I said. The moment the words were out, I knew this was a bad idea. He seemed to read my mind.
And if something goes wrong, do you want to get sent back to South Korea or to China? If the Chinese figure out you're a defector too.
The thought was left hanging in the air. He had me. There was nothing I could say. Every hour of the day for the past week, I had been my family's sole lifeline. But now control was being taken from me. I would have to leave them in the hands of a man I absolutely did not trust. At dawn, the air was already humid and noisy with the cries of unfamiliar birds. The alley smelled of rotting garbage. It took us just minutes to prepare ourselves. My mother would take only a small bag and gave me her winter clothes. I went out to buy toiletries for her and Mino. I checked the remaining cash in my wallet. I did not have much left, and still had to buy my plane ticket to Seoul. I went with them to the coach station. I gave Mino 1,000 yuan, $150. I wrote my South Korean cell phone number down for him and my mother, and told them to memorize it. We said our goodbyes. I did not want to let go of their hands, but Mino gave me his grin and said,
Nuna, we'll be all right.
I watched the coach until it had turned the corner and disappeared from view. Please be safe. The dice were rolling again. Now it was all in Fortune's hands. I stayed behind in Kunming until I'd heard from Mino, who called that evening. They had arrived at the border without incident. They would cross at dawn, when Mr. Fang would bribe the guards. At 5 a.m. he called again.
We're in Laos.
Relief washed over me like warm spring water. The end of the journey was in sight. For days my nerves had been wound to breaking point. Now, as the tension drained from my body, I was so tired I could barely move. I found a post office and mailed back the 2 borrowed IDs. Then, with some hesitation, I called my boyfriend Kim in Seoul. I hadn't spoken to him for more than a week, and had told him nothing about what I was going to do. I had not answered his worried text messages. When I told him where I was, however, his shock was greater than his hurt.
Where?
In the background, I heard the business meeting he was in go quiet. I briefly told him what I'd done, and that my family was now in Laos, heading for the South Korean embassy. There was a stunned pause on the end of the line. Finally, he said,
I don't know what to say.
Then I heard that gentle laugh. Come back quickly. He thought I was insane, he said, but I heard the note of admiration in his voice. I've got to hear all about this. I sat in the back of the taxi, satisfied that I'd accomplished a difficult mission, and I couldn't wait to get out of the grime and humidity of Kunming. We were approaching the departures terminal when my phone rang. It was Mr. Fang. I didn't hear him at first, because a plane roared so low overhead I could see the streaks of rust on its fuselage. All I got was the word, problem. My stomach turned to stone. Problem? I was staring at the back of the taxi driver's head, with the phone at my ear.
The police picked them up.
Chapter 46. Lost in Laos. I screwed my eyes shut. This can't be happening to me. Which police? Chinese?
Laotian.
Where? When?
I don't know.
You don't know? My voice rose to a shout. Where are they and what are you going to do?
There's nothing I can do, little miss, he hissed.
They were stopped at the checkpoint by police. We could have rescued them. You didn't give me enough money. I gave you 50% as agreed. We were working with police and one of the guards at the checkpoint. If you'd given me 100% of the money, I could have paid to have them let go. But you didn't.
With a tremendous effort, I kept my anger under control. Anger would only cloud my thinking, and I had to think. All right. Okay. Where do you think they are?
Probably Luang Namta.
Luang Namta? Where the hell is that?
The first town about 25 miles from the border.
I ended the call and covered my face with my hands. Until 2 days ago, I hadn't known Laos existed. I had never even heard the name, or maybe I had forgotten it.
Laos was one of North Korea's few remaining allies in the world, and still communist. The Lao People's Democratic Republic, to give it its official name, would have congratulated the dear leader on his birthday each year, and this would have been reported in the media. Pyongyang makes headline news of diplomatic pleasantries, the regime's attempts to suggest that the ruling Kim is loved and admired the world over.
Laos. I couldn't even picture it. Just a dark place on the far edge of China that had swallowed my mother and my brother. The taxi pulled over. There were people everywhere wheeling luggage. All the strength had gone out of me. My voice sounded wan. Please take me to the coach station.
You said the airport, the driver exclaimed.
I know, but now I'm going to Laos. He turned and peered at me as if I needed a psychiatric ward, not a coach station.
All right, he said slowly, starting the car again.
I called Mino, but his battery had died or the phone had been taken from him. How can I contact them now? Somehow, I would have to find him and my mother by myself. I felt so weak when I reached the coach station, I could barely lift my backpack. I removed all the cold-weather clothing and gave it to the taxi driver. He was grateful, and again looked at me oddly. My journey ended at noon the next day, at the last station in China. My mother and brother had been here 24 hours earlier. During the long ride, and with some dinner, my energy had started to revive. I asked for directions, hoisted my backpack, and walked toward Laos. The Chinese passport control was in a modern building surrounded by low hills dotted with tropical trees. The sky was a beautiful washed blue, I noticed, clearer than anything I'd seen in Shanghai or Seoul. Vast white clouds sailed over the hills. About 20 people were waiting in line to have their passports stamped. A few were backpacking white Westerners in high spirits. I looked at them with envy. They were inhabitants of that other universe, governed by laws, human rights, and welcoming tourist boards. It was oblivious to the one I inhabited, of secret police, assumed IDs, and low-life brokers. Standing apart from them was one white man no one could miss. He was in his early 50s, strongly built and extremely tall, looming head and shoulders above everyone else. He had pinkish skin and sandy-coloured hair that North Korean kids would gawp at on the rare occasions they saw a Westerner. He and I seemed to be the only lone travellers. We crossed the border. The contrast with modern China was stark. The Laotian passport office was a squat, mud-colour building. It was clear at once that this was a poor country. We filed on board a spluttering 20-seater bus. The tall white man got on also, folding his legs awkwardly between the wooden seats. Bouncing through the hilly countryside on this bone shaker, I stared again at the clean turquoise sky. It made the vegetation seem extravagantly lush. Hardwood trees and rubber trees, by the look of them, and fields of sugarcane and wild flowers everywhere. Enormous purple hibiscus and golden jasmine hanging down from the canopies of the trees. In a more relaxed frame of mind, I probably wouldn't have noticed such things so keenly. But in my anguish, I was seeing all this as beauty denied to me. I would not have any chance to enjoy it. Laos is one of those big, small countries, like Korea. It's a little larger than both Koreas combined, and much longer than it is wide, about 650 miles from north to south. It is landlocked and poor, and surrounded by better-known countries, China, Vietnam, Thailand, Burma, and Cambodia. I had entered the country at its northernmost tip and was heading south. The journey to Luang Namta took an hour.
When I got off, the tall white man and three or four others got off too.
Luang Namta is the capital of the province of the same name. There were many Westerners about, wandering the markets and lounging on hostel verandas. Apart from the police station and one or two guest houses, the town was made up of single-story houses, with telegraph wires crisscrossing every street. I had to find a local who could help me, so I asked directions for the local Chinese restaurant. The owner was a tubby, friendly family man, who reminded me a little of Mr. Ahn. "I'm looking for two North Koreans who were arrested yesterday," I said in Mandarin. I gave him a big smile. "If you can help, I'll eat my meals here every evening." He laughed.
"Well, start at the immigration office," he said. "There's a holding cell there."
Straight away, he offered to take me there on the back of his scooter. His name was Yin, he said. The immigration office was closed and looked deserted. I stood outside, tilted my head back and shouted,
"Omaya! Minoya! Naya! Mother, Mino, it's me!"
Nothing.
"Let's try the police station," the man said.
The police shook their heads when we asked them. "No North Koreans here," they said. Our last stop was the prison, some distance away. The police told us this place was for real criminals. I didn't expect my family to be here. It was a compound of single-story buildings surrounded by a high mud wall. Again, I yelled as loudly as I could.
"Omaya! Minoya! Naya!"
Outside the main gate, off-duty guards were sitting around with some local girls. They had taken their uniform jackets off and were drinking beer from bottles and laughing.
"No North Koreans here," they said. "Just drug dealers and murderers."
They added that this was not the sort of place someone like me should be visiting. Darkness falls fast in the subtropics. Yin offered to take me to my guest house, saying it was dangerous for me to walk alone in the street. I thanked him and told him I'd be fine. I was clinging to any hope now. I thought there might be a chance that my mother and Mino had escaped and were wandering around. As I approached the lights of the town, the traffic increased. Tuk-tuk slowed down beside me. The driver shouted and whistled at me in Lao and stirred up clouds of dust and exhaust fumes. I walked around for hours, looking at every face I saw. It was a Friday night. My search could not resume until after the weekend. I had no choice but to stay in town. On Monday morning, I went straight to the immigration office. A group of men in dark green uniforms were sitting about on the benches outside. The place seemed sunk in torpor. I sensed straight away that nothing here happened quickly. They eyed me with suspicion. I introduced myself as a volunteer from South Korea who come to Laos to help two North Koreans. I showed them my passport and the visa. None of them stirred. I thought no one had understood me. Then one of them said,
"Yes,"
in Mandarin, and swatted a fly from his face.
"Two North Koreans were caught at the border and brought here."
Chapter 47. Whatever it takes. At last, I was getting somewhere. "Can I see them?"
"You'll have to make an official request at the police station," the man said. "There's no point doing that until we've completed the paperwork."
Nothing about the attitude of these men suggested that paperwork was given any priority, but I was finally on familiar ground. I spent the next 7 days going back and forth between the police station and the immigration office, establishing relations with the officials, working on them to build a rapport. I knew I would have to bribe. I tried to think how my mother would have dealt with this, with a combination of charm, persuasion, and cash. I was friendly. I flattered them. I learned their names and their foibles. I went to the immigration office early each morning before anyone else and waited on the bench outside so that mine was the first face they saw. I took packets of cigarettes for everyone. If I didn't do that, if I just sat and waited until I was called, I knew I could be here for weeks or months. Here, an administrative matter that could have been dealt with in minutes was stretched to hours or days. The humidity of the afternoon sapped the life out of everyone. But each day, I felt I was inching closer towards my goal. The officials in immigration wanted Marlboro Reds, they had told me, the most expensive cigarettes. Once it was plain to them that I was agreeable, and opening a channel to them, their corruption became naked. At every one of my visits, they'd ask how much money I had withdrawn from the ATM. $100, I'd say, or just 50. With a flick of the hand, they'd ask to see it. Then I'd hand over the wad of kip, the local currency, to show them. They'd take about half the notes, sometimes more, and give the rest back to me. After a few days of this extortion, and the cost of my meals and my lodging, my money was almost gone. I had no choice but to make the call I was loath to make. To Kim in Seoul, who immediately transferred funds. I was immensely grateful, and told him this was strictly a loan. I would repay him, just as I had repaid my uncle in Shenyang. After my morning visit to immigration, I had little to do in the afternoons, so I would sit and read in a place called the Coffee House, a Western-style cafe that served Thai and Western food. I could remember a little English, but could not read the menu, so I asked a waiter what another customer near me was eating. "Noodles," he said, using the English word. I ate noodles every day. After a week, I wanted a change and rang Kim to ask him the English word for pap. "Rice," he said. "Lice," I repeated. "Not lice, rice. They're two different things. You must ask for rice." "Got it. Lice." I had my lunch every day at the coffee house and dinner at Yin's Chinese restaurant. To cut down on spending, I started skipping breakfast. I didn't care. It made me feel solidarity with my mother and brother. I didn't dare imagine what they were eating, or how little. One afternoon at the coffee house, I saw the tall, sandy-haired man again, who had gone very pink from the sun. His eyes met mine in greeting as he lumbered by, like a giant. I smiled. After 7 days, the immigration office chief, a big, lazy man whose gut strained against his green uniform shirt, said that he would take me to where the two North Koreans were being held. I felt an enormous relief. We got into his car. He said,
"How much money are you bringing?"
I showed him what was in my wallet. Without counting, he helped himself to half. There was no pretense about a fee or expenses. This casual, shameless robbery by one of the town's senior officials angers me now. But at the time, it didn't. I had a single-minded strategy to reach my family. "Whatever it takes," I thought. "I'll do whatever it takes. Humans are selfish and care only for themselves and their families. Am I any different?" To my surprise, we arrived at the main prison I had visited the first day, where the people drinking outside had told me indifferently that there were no North Koreans here. If I'd known that my Omar and Mino were indeed in this place, I would have visited every day, even if all I could do was send them good thoughts. I would have yelled over the wall, "Omaya! Minoya! Don't worry, I'm here!" I would have come from the immigration office every afternoon and sat here until dusk had fallen and the cicada sounds filled the night. The prison wardens told me I could meet my mother in the women's section of the prison, but would not be allowed into the men's section to see Mino. They led me through a courtyard of mud walls to a large black gate. With a clanking of locks and a ferocious groan, it opened sideways. Standing behind it, alone, was my mother. She glared at me for a moment with an odd, distant expression. Her appearance devastated me. She was much thinner. Her hair was greasy and plastered to her head. For some reason, she had one hand on her hip and was tilting oddly to one side. Suddenly, she ran toward me, threw her arms around me, and began to sob. She had on the same clothes and rubber flip-flops as when I'd last seen her in Kunming. "I thought you'd gone," she wailed. "I thought I'd never see you again.
A second ago I thought I was dreaming, so I pinched my side until it hurt.
No wonder she looked at me strangely. She ran her hands over my face, just as she had after she crossed the Yalu, making sure I was real. Holding her in my arms, I too had begun to cry, but I forced myself to stop. I wiped my eyes with the palm of my hand and composed myself. I didn't want to complicate matters by letting the guards know I was her daughter. I sat with her in the prison courtyard. She was being held in a cell for foreign women. One Chinese woman had been there for 10 years, she said. Pictures of her family hung on the walls. They had no clean water. They had to drink and wash from the same ration of dirty water each day. A couple of days earlier, they'd heard the guards beat a Thai male prisoner to death. His wife was in the same cell as my mother, and she wailed without cease.
"It's pure hell," she said. "We should never have left home."
Images I'd blotted out until now, of fouled latrines, female violence, public sex and a murderous lack of hygiene, came flooding into my mind. There was nothing I could say, but there was no going back now. The police had taken all the money I'd given her in Kunming. I slipped her some local currency when the guards weren't looking so she could buy some food. After I'd seen her, I returned to town and at once called the South Korean embassy in Vientiane.
"It's dangerous for you to stay there by yourself," the consul said.
"Leave Laos now and let the embassy take care of matters." This sounded encouraging. How long will it take them to get out?
"We have to go by the book, unfortunately. There are no shortcuts.
We'll submit a request for information and ask permission to visit. But of course that all takes time."
"How long?"
5 to 6 months. My head slumped into my hand. But I was not surprised. I'd seen for myself the sluggish apathy of this country's bureaucracy. I simply could not leave my mother and Mino in that place. The prison interpreter turned to me.
$5,000, he said simply.
My mouth fell open. I looked from him back to the superintendent. His elbows were on his desk, his fingers tapping together. He did not blink. A slow-turning electric fan ruffled his hair, which he periodically smoothed back into place.
"Impossible," I said.
The superintendent shrugged.
"In US dollars,"
he said, and made an up-to-you gesture with his hands. Over the following days, I went early to the prison, with gifts and bribes for the superintendent. Again, I was creating a rapport. The interpreter told me that I was very lucky. Until 2 years earlier, Laos had sent all defectors back. The policy had only changed after an international outcry.
"Now we just fine them," he said.
Slowly I managed to bring the amount down. Negotiations finally stalled at $700 apiece. Every time I was allowed into the courtyard to see my mother, the superintendent took half of my cash, however little it was. I would sit with her in a shaded spot and update her on my progress. When I told her I was struggling to raise the funds, she handed me a small dirty plastic cylinder. Inside was the cash I'd given her earlier. She'd only used a little to buy drinking water. I figured that $700 was probably close to the official fine, but it was still far out of my reach. By this time, almost all the money Kim had sent had been used up. To add to my worries, during my next visit to my mother, she had brought along 3 bedraggled people to meet me. North Korean defectors who had been caught a month earlier. They were an old woman and an unrelated middle-aged mother and her daughter. My mother was overwhelmed with compassion for them. She wanted me to help them, too. I looked at them in dismay, yet I knew I would try to help. They handed me all the money they had hidden in their private parts. It came to $1,500, far short of the total we'd need. By now, my 15-day visa was about to expire. The 2 female officials who ran the visa office in Luang Namta told me they could go to the capital, Vientiane, with my passport to renew my visa. But as it was expiring in just one day, they would have to fly. I'd have to pay their airfare and expenses. It would come to several hundred dollars. I walked back to the coffee house in a trance. I felt as if I was being fleeced of everything I had, and my family held to ransom. I slumped into a chair in the window and tried to think, but every thought came to a dead end. There were no options. I had no idea what to do. I closed my eyes. I was about to start beseeching aloud the spirits of my ancestors, not caring who heard me, when a very tall figure blocked my light and spoke to me in English. I looked up. Sunlight glinted through sandy hair.
"Are you a traveller?" he said.
Chapter 48. The Kindness of Strangers. A tall white man had said the word traveller. I vaguely knew it, but I hadn't understood his question. By now I had got to know the waiters at the coffee house and called over the one who could speak English and some Mandarin. He translated for us.
"Most people only stay here a day or two," the tall man was saying. "You've been here weeks, like me. Are you on business? I'm just curious."
This was the first time a white person had ever spoken to me. His eyes were a pale blue, and he had a trim, sandy beard that was turning grey. He seemed more shy of me than I was of him. The English threw me. I couldn't find the words. I gestured for him to join me and opened an English-Korean translation function on my cell phone. Slowly, and with many embarrassed laughs and pauses, we communicated. I told him that I was a South Korean volunteer trying to help five North Korean defectors who were now in prison for illegal entry into Laos. The man looked very surprised, and I saw pain in his eyes. I searched for more words and told him that the Laotian government was demanding a huge fine.
"How much?" he asked.
"Each person, $700. American money." He scratched his beard and stared into the road for a while. Then he made a gesture that said, "Wait here a moment," and another to indicate that he had to make a phone call. He walked to the other end of the cafe, made a call, and returned after a few minutes. I would never in my life have imagined what happened next. He tapped the words into my cell phone. In Korean, it said, "I've just made a phone call to a friend in Australia. After talking it over, I've decided to help you." My defences shot up. Why? Why would a white 50-something male all of a sudden care about the problems of some Koreans he'd never met? I searched his face for a clue. I dismissed the thought that his motives were sexual. I think I would have detected that in his eyes. I decided that he was probably making some feel-good gesture that he would end up not honouring. I told myself not to get any hopes up.
"Thank you,"
I said in English. He seemed to sense my doubt. He again tapped into my phone. It said, "I met two North Korean women while I was travelling in Thailand. Their story moved me very much." He again made the "wait here" gesture. I watched him walk across the street to the ATM. He returned holding a thick wad of green bills. To my astonishment, he was putting hundreds of US dollars into my hand. "This is some of the money for the fines. I'll withdraw the rest tomorrow." Was I dreaming? I was struggling to comprehend what had happened and express gratitude at the same time. With the help of the cell phone dictionary and our translator waiter, the tall man explained that he was on a 2-year journey around Southeast Asia. He'd intended to leave for Thailand tomorrow, but was willing to stay and help if I wanted him to, and visit the prison with me.
"Of course,"
I said, when I finally understood. This kindness and willingness to become involved completely floored me. My next thought was that if this impressive man came to the prison with me, I would not have to face that superintendent alone.
"Great," he said. "Why don't you move to my guest house? It's easier to talk there. We'll go to the prison together in the morning."
He said this very carefully, and in a way so that I would not misunderstand his good intentions. I nodded dumbly. "We'll have dinner later if you like," he said. "Bring your bag."
"Sure,"
I said blankly. He held out his hand. "My name's Dick Stulp, from Perth, in Australia." I shook his hand. I had not even asked his name. He turned to walk away, but I held on to him. In halting English, I said, "Why are you helping me?"
"I'm not helping you."
He gave an embarrassed smile.
"I'm helping the North Korean people."
I watched him go. Something marvellous happened as I walked outside. All that locked-up beauty I'd seen in this country, and felt I was being denied, suddenly opened. I could smell the scent of jasmine in the trees. The sun and the stately white clouds were celebrating my mood. The whole world had just changed. Dick's guest house was far nicer than mine. I had not expected him to pay for my room, on top of what he'd already done, but he did. When you've lived your whole adult life as I had, calculating the cost of even the smallest decision, such generosity wasn't easy to accept. It involved a loss of control. All I could do was say thank you. Not once did he ask for anything in return. I had never before experienced such detached generosity without some connection or debt attached. If we had been two lone Koreans from Haesan meeting in Laos, or two young people in a crowd of old people, I might have understood the impulse. But Dick's simple kindness took no notice of age, race, or language. It crossed my mind that perhaps he was so rich that money meant little to him. But I learned later that he was not a rich man. At dinner, I joined Dick at the table with five others, a German couple in their 50s, a middle-aged Chinese woman who made documentary films, and a young Thai woman with her German boyfriend. Everyone spoke in English. I had a very hard time following, but I didn't care. I was so relieved not to be alone. I realized I would have to learn English. It was the world's common language. It was a relaxed and enjoyable evening. I laughed and smiled for the first time since leaving Seoul. Dick and I rented a scooter to go to the prison. We took fruit, food, and blankets. He didn't know the lady in the prison was my mother, and that her son was my brother, and that I was North Korean myself. But if he had, it wouldn't have changed anything. I wanted to tell Dick the truth about my identity. He deserved to know. But North Koreans wear masks from such long habit that it's difficult to cast them off. I held on to him as he drove the scooter. On the way, he stopped at the ATM to withdraw the rest of the money for the fines. My most basic assumptions about human nature were being overturned. In North Korea, I'd learned from my mother that to trust anyone outside the family was risky and dangerous. In China, I'd lived by cunning since I was a teenager, lying to hide the truth of my identity in order to survive. On the only occasion I trusted people, I got into a world of trouble with the Shenyang police. Not only did I believe that humans were selfish and base, I also knew that plenty of them were actually bad, content to destroy lives for their own gain. I'd seen Korean Chinese expose North Korean escapees to the police in return for money. I'd known people who'd been trafficked by other humans as if they were livestock. That world was familiar to me. All my life, random acts of kindness had been so rare that they'd stick in my memory, and I'd think, how strange. What Dick had done changed my life. He showed me that there was another world where strangers helped strangers for no other reason than that it is good to do so, and where callousness was unusual, not the norm. Dick had treated me as if I were his family or an old friend. Even now, I do not fully grasp his motivation. But from the day I met him, the world was a less cynical place. I started feeling warmth for other people. This seemed so natural, and yet I'd never felt it before. Reverend Kim had warned me of many checkpoints along the road to Vientiane. The journey by road would take 18 hours and pass through three provinces, each governed independently enough for us to risk being jailed and fined another three times. His advice was to hire a police van for the whole journey. This sounded like a good idea. If the uniformed immigration police took us, we would have protection. The immigration police chief told me it was possible, but the sum he asked for was too much. I pleaded poverty and bargained him down to $150 a head for the six of us, my family plus the three other North Koreans. But I still did not have enough. Once again, Dick stepped in and paid. The police told Dick he could not go with us to Vientiane. He insisted, thinking his presence would help protect us, but they were adamant. They didn't want him there. In the morning, he rented a scooter and followed the van to the prison. The van, a new Toyota, was at least comfortable. The five prisoners were led out, and I saw Minot for the first time in weeks. He was very pale, and his face was covered in terrible acne. But he grinned at me, as if there'd been nothing to complain about. My tough brother, I thought. I felt proud to be the sister of such a man. By this time, they all knew who Dick was and what he had done. One by one, they shook his hand and bowed with gratitude and disbelief. The old lady managed to say in English, "Thank you very much." The van's engine was running. We were ready to go. Dick said he was leaving for Thailand. He gave me his phone number and email address, and then one final overwhelming gift. The money for my flight home. "You need this more than me." He was saying goodbye to me before I could thank him properly. He swung his leg over the scooter and rode away, shouting, "Get in touch if you need me." My angel vanished as suddenly as he'd appeared. We set off for Vientiane, six of us accompanied by a senior policeman, the prison translator, and a police driver. As part of the deal, I had to pay for the meals of all three of them along the way, and they ate gluttonously when we stopped for lunch and dinner. As Reverend Kim had warned, there were regular checkpoints along the road, but the van was waved through each time. This gave us a tremendous feeling. We passed through hilly countryside dotted with mahogany trees and small picturesque villages. The windows were open to let in the breeze, and everyone seemed to breathe deeply, scenting freedom. Minot told me what had happened after I'd last seen him and my mother in Kunming. Near the border, Mr. Fang had guided them to the foot of the hill.
"This is as far as I take you," he had said. "The border's over that hill."
Minot listened carefully to his directions.
"Keep going straight and you'll come to a small, empty house. Go inside. A man will come. Follow him."
He and my mother were shocked to find themselves suddenly alone and in complete darkness. They started to climb. The terrain soon became thick jungle, and a light rain was falling. It was extremely slippery, and there was no path to follow. They had to pull themselves up by grabbing at branches and vines until their hands and faces were scratched and bleeding. In pitch dark, they had no sense of where they were. They tried to keep moving in a straight line, up what now seemed like a mountain, not a hill. It was almost too much for my mother. She said that if Minot hadn't been with her, she would have lost her way and died. After a couple of hours, when they were almost down the other side of the mountain, a figure sprang up in the darkness in front of them. A man had been crouching in the undergrowth and stood to block their way. Minot could make out the glint of a badge on a uniform. The man held up the fingers of one hand and rubbed them together to mean money. Then he made another gesture to indicate two cuffed hands. "Money or I arrest you." Minot had separated the money I'd given him and put it in different pockets. He took out 300 yuan. $45.
"No," the man said in English.
Minot gave him another 500, $75. The man smiled and let them on their way. Shortly after, and by some miracle, they found the empty house the broker had described. It was hidden in thick forest. Another man was indeed waiting there. He gestured for them to sleep, spread out some flattened cardboard boxes, and lay down. They watched as he fell asleep. He looked poor, my mother thought. When it was light, he loaded them into a tuk-tuk and drove them to a bus station. He pointed at a particular bus and told them to get on. Minot assumed the man would board it with them, but he disappeared. Again, they were on their own with no idea where they were heading.
One of the broker's men is sure to be on the bus, Minho said, trying to reassure my mother. He'll make himself known at the right moment.
In fact, the broker's man, a policeman, was supposed to be at the next checkpoint, but due to a mix-up, was not manning his post when the bus arrived. My mother and Minho were handcuffed and put into a police car. I was glad I only learned this now. The thought of my Omar in handcuffs would have tormented me. At the prison, Minho's remaining cash was taken off him by the gangster inmates who helped the guards maintain control. We arrived in Vientiane in the early morning. It was not like any capital city I'd imagined. There were no tower blocks. It was almost entirely low-rise, with buildings separated by lush tropical greenery. There seemed more gardens than buildings. We turned onto a leafy street of large, official-looking buildings topped by flagpoles. I assumed this was the embassy quarter. My eyes were scanning the road ahead, searching for the South Korean flag. We stopped outside one of these buildings, which had a plaque written in Lao. There was no South Korean flag.
"What's this place?" I said to the translator.
"The Vientiane Immigration Office," he said. "Let's get out."
I was immediately on my guard.
"Why?"
"Just procedure. Someone from the South Korean embassy will come this afternoon."
In my dealings with the prison superintendent, I had built up a rapport with the translator and had slowly won his sympathy. He seemed decent and more honest than the others. I watched as he got into a long conversation with the senior police officer. The translator had told me we would go directly to the South Korean embassy. He did not seem pleased with what the senior police officer was telling him.
"What's happening?" I said.
"Don't worry, please get off."
We took our bags from the van and were taken to the second floor of the immigration office. We left our bags in a corner and sat down to wait in silence. I had an uneasy feeling about this. Then an immigration official entered and called my name.
"Please follow me."
I told my mother and Minho I'd be back in a few minutes. One of the North Korean women asked me to buy toiletries.
"We have just a few questions,"
the official said as we walked along a corridor. "I don't want to be separated from the group."
"It's all right, I'll take you back."
He led me to an air-conditioned conference room where four officials in green uniforms were waiting. One was a lipsticked woman in her mid-40s who was introduced as the chief of the immigration office. Her epaulettes had gold stars. She spoke in Lao. One of the officials in uniform translated into Mandarin.
"Do you know why we're questioning you?" she said coolly.
"I have no idea."
"Because you're a criminal."
Chapter 49. Shuttle Diplomacy. I opened my mouth, but words failed me. My first thought was that this was some absurd misunderstanding, or that I'd been brought into the wrong room. I looked around at each of the officials. They were all watching me.
"Why am I a criminal?"
"The North Koreans entered our country illegally," she said. "They are criminals. You helped them."
I'd been feeling a simmering anger ever since